sex, intrigue, revenge, murder. No, it's not the latest Netflix obsession. It's today's gospel passage. The word of the Lord? At best, it seems to have wandered in from the Old Testament, this archaic tale with its blood-drenched finale and extremely questionable family values. Then there's our actual Old Testament reading, with King David making like a Dancing with the Stars contestant, wearing not much more than what the good Lord gave him, his eyes on the mirror ball trophy of God's favor. He is dancing for joy, it seems. He and the gathered multitude dancing before the Lord with all their might, with songs and lyres and harps and tambourines and castanets and cymbals. Party! We might compare David's joyful dance of life with Herodias's grim dance of death. Or contrast the revered ruler David, the chosen of God, with the oppressive ruler Herod, the agent of empire. But what draws my attention today is not so much the victorious King David, clad in a loincloth and whirling ecstatically before the ark, that powerful symbol of God's presence, nor the decadent King Herod, celebrating his birthday in headline-making style. It is a young woman watching, solitary and steely-eyed, from a window. A young girl dancing, intent and alone, before an audience of wine-gazed men. Michal, daughter of Saul, looked out of the window and saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, and she despised him in her heart. Who is this despising woman? Her name is Michal, daughter of Saul, the first king of Israel, David's mentor and arch rival, now dead. She's a king's daughter, but also a king's wife, David's wife. Once upon a time, she had loved David. Her father, learning of her love, used it to his advantage, promising David Michal's hand in marriage and naming a bride price of a mere 100 Philistine foreskins. Seriously. The idea being that in attempting to harvest, shall we say, those 100 foreskins from Israel's hated enemy, David would surely come to grief. No such luck for Saul, and perhaps not for Michal either, as we shall see. David killed 100 men and became Saul's son-in-law, husband of Michal, who loved him. Oh, truly she did. When Saul hatched yet another plot to kill David, Michal helped David escape in the middle of the night, deceiving her father, the king. But as David and Saul waged battle after battle, we learn that at some point, Saul dissolved Michal's marriage to David and gave her to another man. What did she think of that? It hardly matters. Her life was not her own. Finally, Saul dies in battle. And David demands the return of his wife, Michal, probably to consolidate support in the northern kingdom. We don't know if Michal had grown to love her second husband, but there's a touching scene of him walking behind her and weeping as she journeys back to David. And the next time we see Michal, she is watching from that window as David brings the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem, dancing joyfully before the Lord, well aware of how the Ark serves to legitimate his rule in the eyes of the people. After the dancing and feasting, in verses we didn't read, Michal comes out to confront David. "How the king has honored himself today," she sneers, her voice rich with sarcasm. "Uncovering himself today before the eyes of his servants' maids, as any vulgar fellow might shamelessly uncover himself." That's harsh. David answers back. "It is before the Lord, who," he reminds her pointedly, "chose me in the place of your father to appoint me as a prince over Israel, the people of the Lord, that I have danced before the Lord." And furthermore, he adds, "I will make myself yet more contemptible than this, and I will be abashed in my own eyes, but by the maids of whom you have spoken, by them I shall be held in honor. Complain all you want. I'm the people's choice. I'm God's choice." Why is Michal so disdainful? She's been portrayed through the centuries as a nag, a shrew, a damper on David's joy. She's been deemed a legalistic Puritan, uncomfortable with David's exuberant nakedness before the Lord. She's been called a pagan, abhorring David's fervor for the God of Israel. Either way, she can't win. Picture Michal watching from the window as her husband dances up a storm. Does she remember dancing at her wedding? When David became her first husband, she his first wife? By now, you'd need at least two hands to count up the number of David's wives and concubines. Does she remember how she loved him? How she'd sacrificed for him? Before her father and brothers would die fighting David? Before she'd been traded back and forth like a stock certificate? Before her love had turned perhaps to hate, certainly to hurt? After Michal's confrontation scene with David, we hear one last word about her. "And Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child to the day of her death." That's often seen as Michal's punishment for stepping out of line, for daring to criticize the king, for being an overly religious or idol-worshiping shrew. Or perhaps she was just done with David. And the text merely states a fact, probably to make clear that God's word was true. No descendant of Saul would ever sit on Israel's throne. What does any of that have to do with Michal? The claims of the text are not her claims. The story is not hers. She is merely a bit player in this saga. But she is present in the scriptures nonetheless. As is another minor character. "When his daughter Herodias came in and danced, she pleased Herod and his guests, and the king said to the girl, 'Ask me for whatever you wish, and I will give it.'" Mark calls her Herodias, like her mother, although first century historian Josephus gives her name as Salome, And that is the name that has stuck through centuries of biblical interpretation and also of art, music, films, paintings, plays. For this scene has lodged, for better or worse, in our collective imagination. Salome, the wanton and seductive temptress who, in some artistic tellings of this tale, falls in love with the charismatic prophet John. He, of course, spurns her advances, and so she seeks revenge. She is also a king's daughter. Herod Antipas, tetrarch of Galilee and Perea, had divorced his first wife to marry Herodias, who at the time was married to Herod's brother, or perhaps half-brother, Herod Philip. Some sources suggest that Herodias, in addition to being our Herod's sister-in-law, was also his niece. Messy. At any rate, John the Baptizer had been telling Herod, "It is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife." And Herodias had a grudge against him. Though it's hard to imagine Herod was pleased either. Many already question the legitimacy of his rule. If his marriage was thought to be offensive in the eyes of God, that would only weaken his claim to his people's loyalty and to the throne. Is Salome the daughter of Herodias with Herod Antipas or with his brother Philip? It's hard to tell. Mark calls her Herod's daughter, though she could be his stepdaughter, and at the same time, possibly his great niece. Whatever the exact relationship, there's certainly an ew factor here. Herodias, the mother, wants John dead. And amidst the unsavory pomp of her husband's birthday bash, she seizes the opportunity. Like millions of parents before and since, she pushes her daughter out onto the floor to perform her party piece for the guests, courtiers and officers and leaders of Galilee and for the king. We see Salome through the eyes of centuries of mostly male artists. See her scantily clad, voluptuous figure, her knowing half smile as she sways before the lustful company of men, glowing like the fearsome heart of evil in the dark. But that picture is all wrong. She is just a girl. Mark uses the same word to describe her as he used of the young daughter of Jairus, whom Jesus raised from death, saying, "Little girl, get up." Salome is a little girl. She could be barely past toddlerhood, going through her cute and innocent paces with sturdy, pudgy little legs. I imagine her, though, as about the same age as Jairus' little girl, about 12, on the brink of womanhood, but still a child at heart. Her body beginning to blossom while her mind struggles to catch up. Her dance may have begun timidly, falteringly, but as she dances on, it probably is seductive, though she doesn't quite know it. Like any preteen girl changing outfits 5 times a day for the sole pleasure of her own image in the mirror, or aping a pop star's sexy moves whose meaning she doesn't fully understand, she is oblivious and lovely. Her dance is lovely, innocent and sensuous, childish and womanly all at once. It is her mother and father who sexualize her, She dances for herself, for the inexplicable joy it gives her. But before the wine-blurred gaze of the men in attendance, she becomes an object of desire, of lust. And she doesn't have a clue. Her mother does. And when her entranced husband foolishly says to the girl, "Whatever you ask of me, I will give you even half of my kingdom," Herodias makes her move. The excited little girl has been faced with too big a decision, and flushed with a triumph she doesn't understand, runs to her mother. "What should I ask for?" And from that moment, the prophet is as good as dead. Much has been made of little Salome's additions to her mother's request. She says, "I want you to give me at once the head of John the Baptist on a platter." But whether those are the overwrought exclamations of a child or the dramatic insertions of our author, it doesn't matter. The head of John the Baptizer was what Herodias wanted, and that is what she got. The king was deeply grieved, we hear. Yet out of regard for his oaths and for the guests, he did not want to refuse her. Just as we heard that Herod had earlier protected John, and even liked to listen to him. I am not much interested in excuses for Herod. I don't believe them. "Gee, I really didn't want to have the poor guy's head chopped off, but I made a promise to a little girl. What's a king to do?" And we know that despite his protest, Herod was haunted by John's death and would wonder if Jesus was John, whom I beheaded, raised from the dead. We note that Jesus, beyond this brief mention introducing the passage, is not present in this story. Just as God, beyond God's presence in the Ark of the Covenant, is not an actor in the exchange between David and Michal. But if God isn't visibly on the scene, does that mean that God is absent? That we are left to our own devices to act as if God doesn't see, doesn't care what we get up to? We might remember that David will be called to account for his sins against God, will not live to see God's temple built in Jerusalem, will see his house divided and his children killed. Is the great King David evil? No. Only all too human. He danced with joy and reverence, but he had no care for the hurt he had inflicted. He danced before the Lord, but he wasn't above seizing the moment to earn political capital. We might remember that Jesus will caution his followers, "If any of you put a stumbling block before one of these little ones, it would be better for you if a great millstone was hung around your neck and you were thrown into the sea." But Jesus will not stop reaching out to the victimized and vilified, the oppressed and the marginalized, the least of his sheep. And we might remember these two daughters of kings, these two daughters of God. Who will speak for them? Manipulated, victimized, vilified, mythologized. They wait in the shadows of the biblical narrative, just as so many wait in the shadows of society's narrative today. Though shamed and slandered for speaking out for justice, for fighting for their own lives and for their children's, those used and abused and then tossed aside like so much refuse, expendable, worthless. Michal sits brooding in the window, her grief and loneliness palpable, her anger mounting. She calls out, urging us to confront the times we choose power over love, the times we trample the least among us because they get in the way of what we want, the times we think that we can glorify God without embodying the love to which God calls us. Little Salome dances on. Once embarrassed and fearful and eager to please, but now oblivious to everything but the beat of the music and the joy of her own intricate steps. Her young figure refuses to bear the burden of centuries of interpretive scorn. As she reminds us of the ways men and women vilify others in order to dodge responsibility for their own actions, use others, body and soul, for their own sordid aims. Two king's daughters, God's daughters, our daughters. They will speak for themselves if we will only listen. And we should. They have so much to teach us. Thanks be to God.